From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Susan Mizrahi is my guest. She's the author of many books, including The Rise of Multicultural America, The Science of Sacrifice, American Literature and Modern Social Theory, The Power of Historical Knowledge, Narrating the Past in Hawthorne, James, and Dreiser, and her latest, A Critical Study of the Work of Marlon Brando. The book is Brando's Smile, His Life, Thought, and Work. Susan Mizrahi, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, and thanks so much for having me on.
I loved your book, and I love Marlon Brando, so it was really a pleasure to read it. And your book is at least partially inspired by access to previously unseen information about Brando, who died in 2004. So what sort of material were you looking at, and what did it tell you about Brando that, you know, maybe watching his movies couldn't tell you?
Well, it was an avalanche to begin with. One of the things, I mean, I should start just by saying that I grew up on Brando films, and I just loved watching, you know, movies. And so I was very familiar with them. And after he died, I started hearing stories about materials of his that were sold off on auction at Christie's. This was in 2005. And it turned out that he had a library of close to 4,000 books, and all of his personal scripts and film notes were also sold at auction, and I heard that they were heavily annotated. So what I did basically is track down all this stuff. It was just lots and lots of stuff that was sold off by the Brando estate to generate money for the heirs. And what Christie's allowed me to do was to get in touch with all the people who had bought significant lots, that is, lots that had scripts and books. And it turned out that people had bought these things because they loved Brando. They loved his movies. And these were people I went all over the place. I went from coast to coast. The first lot I saw was in Rhode Island, and the last one was in Santa Ynez, California. Someone in Munich, Germany, had bought, you know, the Byrne script. And then it turned out that the biggest book collection was in Moscow.
So you had to go to Germany and
Russia?
What
happened is in these cases, you know, my budget wasn't that good. I was planning a trip to Moscow, but what happened is the guy finally agreed to bring all the books to the Bronx. So I spent months in the Bronx just looking over all of
that's
these.
Not, you know, I mean, the Bronx is nice, but there's no St. Basil's Cathedral there or anything.
That's right. No, this was not a great trip to Moscow, but it was just an amazing thing that it was worthy of a spy novel. That the biggest part of Brando's book collection, it was something like 2,900 books, would end up in Moscow in the hands of a collector who lived near the American embassy there. But it was an astonishing collection. That's the thing that just moved me about it. I mean, I should mention, too, that another big chunk of the library was bought by Johnny Depp, who was a close friend of Brando's. And because Depp knew Brando so well, he knew which books were the most important to Brando. So he had the 700 book collection on the American Indian. And this was really an astonishing collection. I spent a week at Depp's house cataloging all these books, just reviewing, photographing the covers, and, you know, looking for marginalia and photographing all of Brando's comments on the books. And he was somebody who held spirited conversations. He was a skeptic, even though he was an idealist, but he didn't trust anybody. He would write in the margin, "Was you there, Charlie?" I mean, that's the most common. The most common marginalia was "get," exclamation point, which was a reminder to himself to get the book that was mentioned in the book he was reading, because he was interested in following out. The curiosity was endless. And I should say that, you know, I'm not claiming Brando was an intellectual. What he was a self-educated man with an unlimited curiosity. And I really think that, you know, one of the things that led previous biographers astray, I mean, this new perspective on him is the product, as you pointed out, of new materials. But it's also true that Brando was a bad speller. He was a terrible speller. In his high school edition of Emily Dickinson's poetry, and he really loved poetry, and he liked Dickinson especially. She was one of his favorites. And he wrote in the margin, nonconformist. You know, he recognized that Dickinson was a rebel, like himself, because Brando was a lifelong rebel. But he didn't know how to spell, so he spelled it wrong. But that's sort of typical of him, that he, you know, as a high school kid, you know, knew that phrase, knew what a nonconformist was. But, you know, he was unschooled. And so I think there was tremendous intelligence, tremendous hunger for knowledge. And he just had to get all this on his own. I mean, that was really a kind of poignant aspect of all of this. Just all of these books, and I'm not kidding you, just books, the deepest part of the collection, I would say, was in psychology, religion, and politics. He, like a lot of people in the 1950s, was fascinated by psychology, and he read a lot of people like, you know, Eric Fromm and Karen Horney. But he also was a lifelong seeker, and though he wasn't a believer in God, he was fascinated by people who did believe and by, you know, religious ideas, especially Eastern religions.
Well, you know, just because someone has 4,000 books doesn't mean that they've read all those books. But you're saying that there's evidence that he read them because he wrote in all of them?
He didn't write in all of them, no. But he wrote in a significant amount of them. He wrote in, I would say that there were annotations in about a quarter of the books, which, if you look at the library of any, you know, I'm an English professor, I probably have, I don't know how many books I have, but I would say that it's probably a similar ratio of annotations to books. And here's the other thing. Brando's books were all cataloged. Each book was inscribed with a number and a letter to indicate their location in his house.
So he had them all over his house, these books?
They were mostly in the parlor, and, you know, I think he had like a study where there were a lot of books. And one of the places where most of the books were was his bedroom. He had tons of books in his bedroom. And the Christie's curators who first went in there told me that one of the things that they were amazed by is how they had ropes across the bookshelves. Probably to protect Brando himself from earthquakes. You know, when you have an earthquake, I mean, the books would go, flying onto him. You know, in bed.
Yes, we know all about that.
Yeah, we can imagine how he needed to have, you know, protection in that place where he spent so much time. But, you know, I say in the book that you know, his appetite for ideas, for knowledge, you know, his desire to understand the world and the people around him, and also animals, was, I think, as strong as, you know, the legendary cravings, you know, his appetites for women and food.
Yeah.
And I think they were all of a piece, really. You know, I see a lot of parallels between among all these appetites.
That is, his quest for knowledge was the same as his quest for eating?
I think there was well, the eating was an addiction.
Uh-huh.
And he admitted that. I mean, his parents and both his sisters, they were all alcoholics. And what Brando said was that eating was his, you know, form of alcoholism. He was worried about alcohol because of this family disposition. And, you know, he's from a long line of Irish alcoholics. His mother's father was from Ireland. He was sort of a notorious drunk, but also a famous doctor in Nebraska. And so Brando's, you know, addiction came naturally to him. But the diet, you know, the eating was, you know, it was a plight. It was something that was very, very difficult. And he had, by the way, tons of diet books. There were dozens of diet books. And, he said there was no diet that he didn't try. You know, lots of books about health. I mean, this was a guy who seemed to have turned to books.
He might have actually eaten some of these books.
I don't know about that. I didn't see any evidence. I didn't see any teeth marks on the book, but, you know. There were, you know, he had a lot of pets, especially, you know, he had raccoons, he had dogs, and, you know, it is, somehow he managed to keep the books away from these creatures, because I didn't notice any torn up. But one of the things about the romances is that the women, lots of the women gave him gifts of books. So a lot of the books are inscribed, you know, I hope we can get together soon, you know, and talking, referring to dates. And, you know, some women made him collections of his favorite poets, you know, with drawings. And so there was clearly people who knew him knew that reading was part of his life. And, in fact, you know, you're in the California area. His sister, Jocelyn, had a...
Yeah, she had a bookshop.
She had a bookshop called The Book Bin in Pacific Palisades. Did you know the place?
I went in there, but never when she was there, sadly.
Oh, really? Well, did it survive her, the book? I didn't know that it actually had that kind of longevity.
I don't know. It was a long time ago. Yeah, and I'm a fan of hers. One of my favorite movies of all time is The Big Heat with Glenn Ford.
Yeah.
She's so great in that. And your book spurred me to watch The Ugly American, one of Brando's films that I had never
seen.
Oh, so glad. And she's great. Yeah. She's really great in that. She gives a touching performance in that.
She's good. Yeah, and that was a tough thing between the brother and sister, that she really was a star on Broadway before he even showed up. And in a sense, I mean, I talked to her son, Brando's nephew, Marty Azanoff, and he said that, you know, he thinks it was a point of tension, you know, that persisted their whole lives, that, you know, he had toppled her from, you know, her role as the family actress, you know, and she was very successful.
She was blacklisted or something for a long time?
Well, in Hollywood, but I mean, on Broadway, she had been very successful. What happened in Hollywood is that she, it's complicated. It's unclear whether it was because of her husband's, you know, connections and some of his friendships and politics, or whether she was confused with someone. That happened, you know, sometimes with the House Un-American Activities Committee too, but. But Brando, you know, did have to go to some lengths to get her off the blacklist, and that's one reason she appeared in The Ugly American, because he made a point of getting her roles. She's also in The Chase.
Yeah,
with
him. Yeah, she's all. I just caught her in an old Dr. Kildare the other day too. She was.
Oh, that's great.
Marvelous.
Yeah.
Actress. Talking with Susan Mizrahi, and her book is called Brando's Smile: His Life, Thought, and Work. What about records? I mean, I know he loved music. Did he have a huge record collection also?
He had a huge record collection, and he was, you know, a really good drummer. He switched to bongo drums after he came to New York. He had been a stick drummer in high school, and he was pretty serious about it. And he had his favorite record was Sketches of Spain, Miles Davis. And what he told his friends, and this is one of his, you know, his typical sort of mystifying statements: if you want to know me, listen to Miles Davis' Sketches of Spain. Now, you know, there's a certain way you can understand that Brando was also a synthetic person. I mean, he was a product of many cultures. He loved languages. He was fascinated, you know, by difference. And, you know, and that was true of his feminizing, but it was also true, I think, of his appetite for travel and for learning about new places. And he had a language book for every country he visited. And, you know, I think part of that was he wanted to seduce the women when he got there and it helped his language. But I think it was also that he really understood that to be able to, you know, operate in a new culture and appreciate it, you needed to know, you know, as much of its language as you could, you know, get before you went there.
So now you looked at all these books and all these notes, and it informed his acting for you?
Oh, absolutely, and not for me. It informed his acting, period. I mean, this is something that is so clear from watching his acting, from looking at the scripts, which he annotated extensively in many cases. You know, he and also the notes. You know, one of the things that really amazed me in reviewing the films again with all of these materials was to recognize how many really good writers, and also composers, by the way. You know, this is the music interest,
right.
How many worked on his films.
Like Leonard and, Bernstein and
Alex
Leonard
North. Bernstein, but also, lots of really, really fine jazz musicians. I think I can't remember the first name, but Grusin, Todd Grusin.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and a number of really terrific composers.
I love Gatto, I think, Barbieri's score to Last Tango in Paris.
It's an amazing score, and there are so many of his films have terrific scores. I mean, he was one on Jacks. Also, I mean, I think it might have won an Oscar for, if not for scenery, if not for the camera work, it was for the music. But the thing about his scripts and his work on the films is that he really attended to so many different aspects of the film work. He knew what kind of camera lens size was in when he was doing a certain scene. I mean, there's an anecdote about The Chase, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with that film. He played a Texas sheriff. That
Jane
was one
Fonda
that,
and this, Robert Redford.
Yes,
and Lillian
yes,
Hellman wrote
Robert
the script.
This was Robert Redford's first film.
Yeah.
And Lillian Hellman wrote the screenplay. Mm. And there was a scene where Brando is beat up by a bunch of town thugs. And Brando actually said to Arthur Penn, "Why don't we slow down the camera for this scene and put a bunch of cameras on us at the same time, and have the actors play the scene instead of having extras?" And he said it will really make the violence authentic. It'll make people really feel the punches land. And they did that, and it was incredibly successful. And according to Penn, they used that for the death scene in Bonnie and Clyde, the scene where Bonnie and Clyde are shot, in that sort of parade of bullets. They slow down the camera in the same way they did it in The Chase. And Penn says in a documentary on Brando that Brando was the source of that idea.
Interesting.
How to film violence. So the point is that Brando really thought carefully about filming, and acting was something that he was both, obviously endlessly talented. He was a gifted mimic, but he also prepared extensively for his roles. He thought about his characters. He insisted on doing their costumes. He did most of his own makeup. I mean, the only time he didn't do his own makeup was for The Godfather, because he knew that was beyond him. That required an expertise that he just couldn't match. I mean, you could say that he knew enough about makeup to know that he wasn't capable of making himself old, as that genius.
Yeah, I think when people watch The Godfather today, they don't realize that Brando was about 46 years old or something.
Oh, yeah, he was really young and vital. And not only that, he actually, in that was one case. I mean, he was good at, I mentioned his diet books. He was as good, or not as good at losing weight as gaining it, but he was good at losing weight. And for The Godfather, he lost so much weight before the filming that he actually had to wear padding to convey, this aged, paunchy.
And a great big
Don.
Cat. He also had to wear a gigantic cat.
Oh, you're talking about the cat is amazing. There are animals in many of his films. I mean, this is a guy who was a kind of, I mean, I would say dog whisperer or cat whisperer, but I think he was an animal whisperer. I mean, he was, there are puppies in Viva Zapata. There's an amazing scene in Burn, which is Brando's favorite film, where he strokes the snout of a horse while he's talking about his failures. It's really one of the most wonderful scenes in his films. And he really understood how he could, convey meaning through touch and through gestures. And that's one of the really crucial things about his acting, that this was someone who understood that if you could raise an eyebrow or shrug your shoulders instead of saying a word or a line, that was more powerful. And that was one of the things I found in his scripts, that he very often would cross out many words and substitute, just a concise phrase or even a shrug or a gesture.
So he would actually write raise eyebrow or...
Yeah, well, it's for The Godfather.
Flex head bump.
Oh, that, the greatest moment in The Godfather, I mean, now everyone has their own favorite moment. There's so many great moments. But one of my favorites is at the end of the first scene when he says, you know, to Tom Hagen, "We're not murderers, despite what this undertaker says." And then he drops his chin and he inhales the rose on his lapel. Now that scene, that line is Brando's. He improvised, he ad-libbed it, and the gesture itself is Brando's. And you know, he was a master of those kinds of those forms of silent forms of expression.
Well, in your book, Susan Mizrahi, you talk about the myths of Brando that you wanted to dispel, and one of those is that his movies in the 60s were inferior, or that the movies in the latter part of his career were inferior. And you know, I think it's really difficult to not look at his career and see, you know, yes, there are these rises, these great moments like The Godfather and like Last Tango and The Freshman and Don Juan DeMarco, but spread out between those are some really bad choices in terms of filmmaking.
Yeah, there are, you know, I'll say a couple of things. First of all, Don Juan is not one of my favorite films, even though it's a very popular film. But I, you know, what I would say is I agree that there were definitely some questionable choices. I mean, I don't talk about Candy, you know, at all, for example.
Yes.
And neither the, you know, there are certain films that I do think, I wouldn't say they're, you know, worthless, but they are, you know, of limited value to film history. But what I argue and, you know, believe is, you know, very clear is that there were plenty of superb performances in the 60s. I think and here's the other thing that I discovered through research, that when you look at the contemporary response to films like One-Eyed Jacks, even Mutiny on the Bounty, which was so controversial, and, you know, just was you know, the whole, it was just a kind of incendiary film in Hollywood, but because, you know, of all the controversy associated with it, it was one of the, you know, film epics like Cleopatra, that, you know, it was, you know, charged with sort of, you know, ruining the studio system. I mean, a lot of exaggeration. If you look at the contemporary reviews, you find that people really appreciated Brando's performances at the time, and that they were successful financially. But beyond that, there are real gems in the 60s that we have completely missed because of, you know, the you know, reigning view of Brando, which is basically, you know, just go from On the Waterfront to Godfather and Last Tango, and you won't have missed anything. You miss a lot. And, you know, I mean, I could talk about the 50s, too, but certainly in the 60s, One-Eyed Jacks is a terrific Western. And Quentin Tarantino called it one of his favorite Westerns. It's on a lot of lists of best Westerns, and it's a film that is well worth seeing, I think, as is Mutiny on the Bounty. But we talked about gems. I think one of the things that I found in the films of the 60s is that many of the films that have been dismissed over time were politically controversial. That is, they assumed really difficult political positions, or, you know, they represent, you know, Brando was doing things that no other actor would consider. For example, he was the first major actor to play a closeted homosexual in Reflections in a Golden Eye. And that was a part. He played opposite Elizabeth Taylor. He was Elizabeth Taylor's Southern officer husband. And they tried. John Huston was the director. It's a wonderful film. And they tried to get a lot of different actors to play the role. And because they asked Brando first, and he was, you know, as usual. I mean, he said, "Oh, I don't know how much you're going to pay me," you know, the usual equivocation. And they went to many other people, and no one wanted to do it. It was like a hot potato. Brando finally came back to Brando, and he said, "Yes, I'll do it." And he just provides in that film an incredible performance. And you know, I think that film is very unjustly neglected. I hope people will go back to it the way you went back to The Ugly American. I will say also about The Ugly American, which is not as good in its own right, I don't think, as Reflections. But it is an important prophetic film about Vietnam.
Oh, it's amazing how prophetic
they,
it is.
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
I mean, and they were thinking, I mean, if you listen to there are lots of tapes of Brando and the producers and director discussing the film. And they're talking, you know, incessantly about the whole Vietnam conflict. And again, you have to recognize that Brando is someone who was reading everything he could get his hands on about Vietnam, about American imperialism, about nuclear warfare. I mean, you know, he was someone who was thinking deeply about these issues prior to, you know, performing these roles in the films. So it is, you know, these are highly considered performances, and I think they're, you know, it's tragic that they're overlooked, you know, these days. And by the way, Byrne is a film, again, Joan Mellon is really a fine movie critic, and she says, you know, outright that it was just too hot to handle at that point. Brando went to meet Black Panthers in order to understand the sentiments and the sort of perspective of revolutionaries in order to play the role he played in Byrne. And so, you know, he understood that, you know, we were talking about some really, you know, fiery political, you know, positions in that film, and that, you know, the subject, you know, slavery in the Caribbean, you know, in the 19th century was highly relevant to the American 1960s, you know, where you had, you know, Malcolm X and the Black Panthers and a lot of you know unrest over race relations.
It's fascinating stuff. The book is called Brando's Smile: His Life, Thought, and Work, and the author is Susan Mizrahi. Thank you so much for being with us on the show, and I hope you come back and talk to us again.
I would love to.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Susan Mizrahi, her book, Brando's Smile, His Life, Thought, and Work. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro, and I'll see you next time.